Can you start tonight?
Yes. Tonight, starting again tonight, we're going to do a very interesting topic that many of you might have learned before and on some level. Rav Avadia has many tshuvos on this, but so do really all the Gedolei HaPoskim, whether it's the Tzitz Eliezer of Moshe Feinstein, etc. And these are various aspects about fertility technologies, such as artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, egg donation, and surrogacy. I don't know if I'll cover everything tonight, or maybe it'll be a two-session one, but at least I want to get a beginning of it. And Bekitzer, the medical acronym that is often used is ART, which simply means assisted reproductive technologies. That's kind of, you know, capital A, capital R, capital T. And of course, it all starts off with the idea that the very first mitzvah in the Torah is pru urvu, to be fruitful and multiply. It's a mitzvah on a Jewish couple. I'm not going to say to have children, because that's not really within their power, but to make whatever efforts they need to do in order to have children. According to halacha, you do not fulfill the mitzvah of pru urvu till you have a son and a daughter. So if you have 10 boys, got to keep trying. 10 girls, got to keep trying. And even after you fulfill pru urvu, and again, I'm not going to talk about contraception tonight, there is a mitzvah basically, unless there are extenuating circumstances, which is very important to know, there's a mitzvah to keep on having kids, but that mitzvah is not because of pru urvu. Pru urvu is the son and daughter, but it's based on a pasuk in the Navi Yeshayahu, which is Lo Tahu Bera'a La Sheves Yitzara. Hashem did not create the world to be empty or desolate. He created the world to be inhabited. And this mitzvah of La Sheves, as it's referred to by Chazal and in Poskim, basically says, gotta keep going. But again, I'm not talking about contraception tonight, other than to just make the simple observation that when a person seeks a dispensation for Miniyat Hirayon, you know, birth control or contraception, there is going to be a very sharp distinction between pre-pru urvu fulfillment and post-pru urvu fulfillment. Meaning, one of the main questions that a Rav is always going to ask is, has there been a biblical fulfillment or pru urvu? Once there is, when you're dealing with the Lashevet mitzvah, there is more leniency. But again, that's not our topic tonight, so I am not really going to talk about it. But before I get into the technicalities of the art, the assisted reproduction, let me just point out an anomaly that at first glance may be difficult to understand. And that is, although the bracha, to be fruitful and multiply, is b'lashon rabim, and therefore it is directed to both Adam and Chava, the commandment of procreation is only on a man, not on a woman. Now, obviously, it's the woman that bears the child, but the way this works is, a man is mechuyev to find a woman, find a wife who is willing to have children. But the woman herself is not commanded in the mitzvah of having children. How do we know this? So the Gemara in Yevamos tells us that it's based on the fact that procreation is defined as a type of conquest. Because what does the Torah say? Actually, sometimes having kids is like, you've got to conquer them. It says, pru urvu umilu es haaretz v'kivshuha. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and conquer it. So since procreation is defined as conquering the world, so the Gemara says, darko shel ish lichposh. It is a male activity to engage in warfare and conquest. It is not a female activity, so women are exempt. Now obviously, a man without a woman cannot have a child. By the way, again, I'm getting at myself, a woman without a man actually could have a child through cloning technologies. And the fact, men are totally superfluous in the procreation process. Men are not needed. A woman can actually create life without a male factor. Men are not able to do so without a woman. Again, maybe we'll talk about cloning in another shiur. But the question still becomes, all right, we have a drasha, that's how we know women are exempt, but what's the logic? Why should women be exempt from procreation? So I'm going to give you just, again, we don't always know. Many things are gezeira sakasuv, and we don't necessarily know. But let me mention two reasons, and they actually work in opposite directions. Reason number one is that sometimes the Torah does not mandate as a mitzvah something that a person would naturally want to do anyway. And it says that women, as a general rule, have a stronger maternal instinct coupled with a biological clock. So the desire and the compulsion to want to have children is naturally stronger in a woman than a man, especially since a man feels he might have indefinite time. A man could have a child, like Strom Thurmond, could have a child 90 years old or whatever it would be. So the concept is, the Torah hits the man over the head by saying, you gotta try to have children, where it's less necessary in the case of a woman. Now, Rav Meir Simcha, the Meshech Chachma, actually says an opposite reason, a fascinating reason. He points out that both pregnancy, and even to a greater degree, childbirth, is a dangerous condition. God forbid, people die in pregnancy, and certainly there is not only infant mortality, there is, God forbid, mother mortality in pregnancy as well. That's why we're in a childbirth, rather. That's why we're a Mechallel Shabbos, to get a woman to a hospital. So the Rav Meir Simcha says the following. The Torah, which is Durachaha Darchei Noam, the Torah is a Torah of pleasantness and sweetness. The Torah will never command somebody to do something that puts their life in danger. The Torah can tell a man, find a partner in life who is willing to take on that responsibility. So the man could be commanded to find the appropriate partner. But the woman herself cannot be commanded to put herself in danger. And that is why the mitzvah of Pru Urvu, the Meshech Chochma says, is not on the woman, it's only on the man, because the woman is a mesukenes. The man finds a woman who's willing to take on this situation, but for the woman herself it's not mandatory. Nevertheless, in spite of the Meshech Chochma's argument, I do have to say that Tosfos writes in a few different places, in Gittin and in Chagiga, that although women don't have the Doraisa commandment of Pru Urvu, they do have the prophetic injunction of Lashevis Yitzara. So there is a level of obligation for a woman as well, but it is not the same level of obligation. Well, normally, of course, the way one does the mitzvah is by marital intimacy. For most of history, that's the way it was done. But the question becomes, if that is not matzliach in different ways, so is there an obligation to utilize reproductive technologies? Reproductive technologies can sometimes be very invasive, particularly for a woman who may not even have the mitzvah of Pru Urvu. In vitro fertilization, for example, involves, a surgery to extract eggs, etc., under anesthesia. So I do want to make a point. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach gives a very interesting psak. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach paskins, and I didn't see anything that Rav Avadya said about this directly, that a couple are not obligated to utilize medical procedures to have children. The mitzvah of Pru Urvu is kederech kol ha'aretz, the normal, basic way to have children. There is no obligation on a man or a woman to undergo surgical correction or surgical procedure. If they want to, they can. But a couple, and of course in the Torah community especially, since having children is such a bracha and such a great mitzvah, most of the time people do invoke, do utilize fertility technologies. But I will tell you this, sometimes people get depleted, people get exhausted, and people's health, a woman's health in particular, can be affected with the hormones that induce superovulation or for in vitro fertilization. And sometimes they feel the woman might feel she can't go on, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's message is, she should not feel guilty, or she should not feel it's an abdication of halacha if she says ad kan, because in point of fact, they weren't even chayef to do it once, even though by and large people do as many times as they can. As you know, Israel, in terms of coverage of fertility procedures, is much more supportive than the United States, in which insurance often will not cover more than the second in vitro attempt. Here, I think you get unlimited coverage in most kupat chalim, and that's basically because, Baruch Hashem, there is a Torah community that very much understands the importance of children, but still, at the same time, it is not a chiyuv, it is not an obligation. So here, I want to talk about a number of fertility technologies. ranging from relatively low-tech to high-tech. So I'm kind of almost going in order, the older ones and then the newer ones. The oldest method of assisted reproduction that's been around for human beings, well, at least 100 years, but the truth is we'll see that it already has a source in Chazal, and in animal husbandry has been around also for hundreds of years, is artificial insemination. Hazchaa malachatit, artificial insemination. That simply means that the sperm will be injected in the woman's body, and that will allow there to be fertilization if the natural progress of the sperm would not be able to move, it does not have motility and the like. Now, artificial insemination can exist in two forms, and you can imagine that one is more controversial than the other. There is artificial insemination of husband's semen, AIH, typical acronym, and then there is artificial insemination using donor semen. So let's take each one separately. Artificial insemination of zera of the husband. What could be wrong? It's the husband's zera going into the wife's body. Is there any halachic problem with that procedure? So there are a few issues. Issue number one is, and again, I do want to emphasize, since this is an issue that does touch on people's individual lives, I do want to emphasize that particular shilas should be directed to your rav. In other words, anything I say here is not meant to be halacha lemaisa, because you need to examine the specifics. But issue number one is the procurement of the zera. There is, of course, a Torah violation about wasting seed, and we learned this out from Er and Onan, who both of them did not want to impregnate Tamar. They didn't want to mar her beauty, so they spilt their seed outside of the body. And this is how the English term onanism got there. Masturbation, all of these things are serious prohibitions. It's called hashchasat zera or hotsaat zera levatola. So one of the questions in fertility technology is the obtaining of sperm in this way a violation of hashchasat zera? There are poskim that say yes, but here Rav Ovadia brings many, many sources that say it's actually the opposite of hashchasat zera. Hashchasat zera is when the sperm is obtained for the purpose of not having procreation. Here, even if the zera is being obtained not through tashmish, not through intercourse, since it is being obtained for the purpose of facilitating reproduction, it is not considered zera levatala, and it would be permitted. Now, in mind, right now, I'm only talking about the zera that's going to be used for fertilization. I am not talking about the zera that's going to be used for testing, and often they'll ask for repeated testings, and then you get into very, very difficult questions of whether that is levatala at some point. But Rav Ovadia does paskin, as do most poskim, that as long as the zera is going to be used for a procreative purpose, it is not called levatala, even though it was not emitted in the context of tashmish. So that's kind of shaila number one. Shaila number two is this. One of the common fertility problems that exists for people who keep taras hamishpacha is that there's only a window. There's around a 72-hour window before and after ovulation in which a woman could get pregnant. And beyond that window, pregnancy would normally not really be possible. Now, there is a problem that sometimes some women might ovulate, either because of various medications they're taking or just part of their natural cycle. They might ovulate the 10th or 11th day after the beginning of their menstrual cycle. Now, since Bederech Klal, a woman cannot go to the mikveh until the expiration of 12 days, because you need 5 days from the bleeding and then 7 clean days, so that would sometimes mean that by the time a woman goes to the mikveh, the window is either severely minimized or it's already passed, meaning to say a woman cannot get pregnant because her ovulation occurred too early in her menstrual cycle, and then you have a very, very difficult problem. There are different ways around this, but one of the ways that the poskim discuss is, well, okay, obviously A man and a wife cannot have relations during Nida. That's very simple. That's obvious. That's an issue of the Oraisa. But what about artificial insemination, or in vitro for that matter, which I'm getting ahead of myself, but what about the sperm is obtained and it is, she's impregnated during Nida? Is there an issue to impregnate a woman during Nida if it is not through an act of marital intercourse? Number one, is that usher? And number two, even if it's not usher, is there a spiritual defect? Because what is the halacha of what's called the ben nida? Okay, it's important to know. We discussed a number of times already the concept of mamzer, that if, God forbid, there's adultery or incest, the child is a mamzer who cannot marry into Klal Yisrael. That's very severe. Baruch Hashem, because otherwise many of us would be in big, 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 big trouble. Baruch Hashem, a child that was born from a husband and wife, where the wife was a nida and didn't keep Taras and Mishpacha, is not a mamzer. And I say it's Baruch Hashem. Hashem was really kind to Klal Yisrael, because logically, a Be'ilas Nida should absolutely be a mamzer. In other words, if you go with the definition of a mamzer, which means any sexual relationship for which the penalty is death or death in the hands of heaven, produces mamzer, and that is the definition. A bia of a nida should absolutely be a mamzer, but we have drushos and interpretations that it's not. So as a result, a child that is born from a nida does not have any halachic disability whatsoever. But it is brought down in some sources that there might be a certain degree of spiritual blemish. Now, the Stipler says that that's not always true, etc., but at least there's a risk. So the question becomes, if the child was conceived not through a forbidden bia, but through artificial insemination during Nida, is there a problem? So Rav Ovadia paskins, and again, other poskim paskin this way as well, that as long as there is no forbidden act of intercourse, artificial insemination or in vitro is permitted when the woman is a nida. And not only is it permitted, but it doesn't even have the spiritual pagam of ben nida, and therefore he says such a procedure is mutar lechatchila. So this is actually one of the solutions we have. I mean, there are other solutions. Sometimes drugs can defer ovulation. Sometimes we can cut down. We can't cut down on the 7 clean days, but we can sometimes do a hepsik tira after 4 days, sometimes even after 3 days, and she can go to the mikveh early. So there are different solutions, but one of the solutions to the problem of the woman who ovulates before going to the mikveh is that artificial insemination or in vitro is permitted during that time. Now, I do want to point out that some poskim, the Minchas Yitzchak, it was the Rav Dayan Weiss was the head of the Eda Charedis in the 70s and 80s. He has an interesting way of doing this, which Rav Ovadia says Badafka shouldn't be done. And that is, I don't want to get too technical here, but it's interesting that the Doraisa law of Nida does not require a woman to wait 12 days before going to the mikveh. The Doraisa law of Nida does not require 7 clean days without bleeding. Doraisa, even if she was bleeding for 6 days, she could count one more day and go to the mikveh after 7 days from the onset of menstruation. So, Dayan Weiss suggested the following idea. That if a woman, let's say, is ovulating on day 10 or 11 of her cycle, she should go to the mikveh after day 7 to take off the status of nida da'oraisa. She could then receive artificial insemination when she's technically not a nida, but no marital intercourse would be permitted until she goes to the mikveh a second time after the 12 days. So she'd go to the mikveh twice, one to take off the status of nida da'oraisa, and that would allow the artificial insemination. And then the other one would be to take off the status of nida midrabanan, which would permit marital intimacy. And this way, he says, you avoid the pagam of ben nida and the like. Rav Ovadia mentions this, but he actually says he does not agree with it at all, because he says there's a very real fear that if she goes to the mikveh, a husband and wife might think everything is okay, and they might actually have marital intercourse, which is a very great aveira. So as a result, he bedavka urged that she not go to the mikveh before the artificial insemination in order to eliminate that type of confusion. So with respect to the AIH, the two problems are Hotzas Zera Levatola and Nida, and there both Rav Avadja and most other poskim have been Machria Lakula on that particular issue. Of course, the question becomes, do you fulfill Pru Urvu by artificial insemination? Because if you don't fulfill Pru Urvu, then in a sense, I won't say there's no point. The point is you still have a child, but is there a Kiyum HaMitzvah? So here, Rav Avadja brings, as really all the sources bring it, the earlier Mefarshim bring it as well, they bring a fascinating teaching from one of the Balei Tosfos, Rabbeinu Peretz. And Rabbeinu Peretz basically says the following. He says that a Nida is allowed to lie down on sheets that may have her husband's sperm, because even though she might get pregnant, there's no problem because it's her husband. Again, that's actually a direct proof to the artificial insemination idea. But he says she could even lie down on sheets that have other people's sperm, because even if she gets pregnant, there would be no particular problem. I'll get to that in a moment. I'm getting ahead of myself there. But the implication is, he says, that there is a fulfillment of Pru Urvu even by artificial insemination, so the husband does have a Kiyum HaMitzvah. Now, let's now talk about AID, which is a much more controversial procedure, as you would assume, and that is, let's say the man is infertile. The man's not capable of having a child. Now, it's a dumber question. If a woman gets impregnated by a sperm donor, that's not going to be a fulfillment of Pru Urvu on the part of the husband, but is it a permissible mechanism to have a child? So here we have an enormously controversial machlokas going back to the 1960s between Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Satmar Rav. Now everyone knows the Satmar Rav, Rav Yael Teitelbaum. We know him as such an anti-Zionist, although this is totally off topic, but I have to tell you one little story about the Satmar Rav during the Six-Day War, which is, you know, the anniversary is, is approaching, or we had recently. And that is, when Hubert Humphrey, you know, Hubert Humphrey was a classic liberal Democrat who was a strong supporter of Israel. So when he was campaigning in 1968 election against Richard Nixon, he wanted to get the Jewish vote because he was so pro-Israel. So somehow, some of his handlers, who didn't really understand the Jewish community very well, they arranged a big rally in Williamsburg. Now Williamsburg was Satmar. Satmar was totally against the state of Israel. And, Humphrey didn't know this chassid, that chassid, Orthodox or not. So Humphrey, you know, had the Satmar Rebbe there in a big Satmar rally. And Humphrey was talking about, I was a Zionist, you know, since 1941. And, you know, I give weapons to Israel and money to Israel, and there's nothing like the Jewish state. The state of Israel, the Zionist people. So there were some of his Jewish advisors realized what was going on, and they were just horrified. Oh yeah, yay! We're going to lose, you know, half a million Satmar votes because of this support of Zionism. But the Satmar Rebbe was smiling and nodding, and people were translating about the Zionist dream. And the Satmar Rebbe said, "Yeah, you talk it very, very nice." And afterwards, one of the advisors went over to the Satmar Rebbe and said, "You know, Rebbe, we have to ask your mechila. You know, the senator just didn't know, or he was actually vice president then, didn't know your views, and he didn't mean to hurt." So the Satmar Rebbe said, he says, "My disagreement with the Jewish state is a family matter. We have disagreements within the family, but they are still our family. And, you know, I don't want a single Jewish person to ever be hurt or be harmed." And it is said that during the Six-Day War, the Satmar Rebbe fasted for all 6 days, basically, because he didn't want a Jewish chayal to be hurt in that war. So that's a very interesting story. So all of us know about the Satmar Rebbe in terms of his Zionism, but he was a phenomenal great Talmud Chacham, and he had other psukim as well. And one of his famous psukim was that if a married woman is impregnated with donor sperm, she has committed adultery. And because she has committed adultery, her husband must divorce her. She's not allowed to stay married. And the child that is conceived from donor sperm is a mamzer, exactly like a child that is conceived from adultery, mamish. This was his position. He equated artificial insemination with donor sperm to be exactly the same as adultery, both in terms of forbidding the woman to her husband and giving the child the status of the mamzer. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote four different responsa. And Rav Moshe was bitterly attacked by Satmar. I mean, Satmar tends to be, not the Rebbe, but Satmar as a group, they tend to be very aggressive, burnt in effigy, and all sorts of things. But Rav Moshe argued a number of times that artificial insemination, even by a donor, even though he said, certainly the husband does not fulfill pru or vu, that's for sure. But he says artificial insemination by a donor is not adultery. Adultery requires intercourse. It does not produce a mamzer. Mamzer requires what's called bias iser, a prohibited act of intercourse. And without intercourse, the child is 100% kosher. Now again, he's not the child of the husband, he is the child of the donor, but he is a kosher child. But Rav Moshe said, even though child is not a mamzer, and even though it's not adultery, donor sperm should be strongly discouraged for the following reason. If the donor is anonymous, which is commonly the case, there is the possibility of secret incest. How do I mean secret incest? Because it's possible that 20 years later, a brother might marry a sister. Because if you have a sperm donor who's giving sperm, so one woman might have a boy and the other woman might have a girl, and the boy and the girl might meet, and this is a shaila of hidden incest. So Mimanashach Rav Moshe says, if the sperm donor is not anonymous, that's bichlal, totally inappropriate for a married woman to be impregnated with a donor that she knows, because emotionally that is adultery, even though it wouldn't be a mamzer. So Mimanashach, to have a known donor is a tremendous precis that cannot be allowed. To have an unknown donor creates the possibility of secret incest. Now, you might say, oh, come on now, what are the possibilities of something like that happening? Well, number one, Rav Moshe makes the point that Chazal were absolutely concerned with the possibilities of incest. This is exactly why, if a woman is divorced and she's pregnant, she's divorced or widowed, she is not allowed to marry for at least 3 months to determine that she's pregnant, because if she were to get married earlier and would have a child after 7 months, we wouldn't always be sure if it is 9 months from the first or 7 months from the second, and it might turn out an incest problem with brother marrying sister. Second of all, I will tell you, there was a fertility doctor in Northern Virginia, happened to be a Jew, unfortunately, Dr. Cecil Jacobson, whose fertility clinic had a very unusual rate of success. Like most in vitro clinics have, whatever it is, 40%, 35%, he was having 60%. See, he was attracting a tremendous amount of business because he somehow had the secret to make all of these procedures successful. It turned out that he was routinely throwing away the sperm of the husbands, and he was just substituting his own. And I guess he was a fertile person, and there was a high rate of success. Now, it was eventually discovered, and he was, he lost his license, and I'm not sure if he went to jail or not, and the like. But he fathered that in this way, I think over 100 kids. And it was stated that had this not been uncovered, the chances of brothers marrying sisters was fairly high, because statistically, demographically, you tend to marry people who are within a radius of 25 miles of your home, and therefore it's likely that somehow they would have met. So these things do, and they have happened, etc. So because of this, though, Rav Moshe then comes up with something that made Satmar even more enraged, and it also made many Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael enraged. And Rav Moshe says the following. Now this is gonna strike you as pretty unusual. He says, if a woman really, 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 really feels that she has to have a biological child, and her husband agrees,
to this. And adoption is not going to help her over this.
Then Rav Feinstein says she ought to have sperm donated by a non-Jew instead of a Jew. Because, here is the thing, in the case of a non-Jew, the halachic incest problem will not be there. Now again, this needs a little bit of an explanation. We know, of course, that the Jewish religion is passed down through the mother. That is matrilineal descent. Meaning, non-Jewish man, Jewish woman, child is a Jew. But there's a corollary to that that people often don't get. That is, if the child is Jewish, that also means the child has no halachic relationship to the non-Jew. Meaning the child does not have a halachic father. Even if father then converts to Judaism, child has no halachic father. Meaning a child that is born from a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother doesn't need to convert. The child is Jewish. But they have no father. Or Hashem is their father, however you want to put it. And in fact, there's a whole question. How do you call up? It's a very common scenario, unfortunately, with intermarriage. How do you call up this child to the Torah? Now, some people want to say, well, you call him up Ben Avram, but that's really incorrect. Ben Avram might be the correct appellation for a non-Jewish child who was converted to Judaism, because all Gerim are the children of Avram. But this child is a Jewish child. This child is not a Ben Avram in the sense of a Ger, but he doesn't have a father. So there's a big machlokas. Some poskim say, call him up by the mother's name. But that's really not such a great solution. That's pretty embarrassing. You know, you call him up, Yitzchak ben Rachel. You know, that doesn't look good. Now, if it's one of those Sephardic, unisex names, Yona or Simcha, you know, maybe it's going to work. But it doesn't work for most Ashkenazic names that are very gender specific. Other poskim say you can call it up by the name of the mother's father. Because we do have a rule that grandchildren are considered to be like children. So if mother's father was Moshe, you can call the child by the name Moshe. Be it as it may. But Rav Moshe says the following. If it's true that a non-Jewish father has no paternity to the child, so if non-Jewish father has a girl through sperm donation from this woman, and non-Jewish father has a boy from some other Jewish woman, technically, the boy and the girl are not halachic brothers and sisters, even though they have the same biological father. So Rav Moshe's argument is that if you want to avoid any possibility of halachic incest, now this doesn't help you for genetic incest, which creates all sorts of problems, but halachic incest would be avoided by non-Jewish sperm. And then Rav Moshe concluded, since in the United States, the vast majority of the population are non-Jews, you can assume that anonymous sperm donation comes from a non-Jewish source, and therefore he says, now he says it's not, he doesn't like this, he says, it's certainly much better not to do this, but if a woman really, really, really is desperate to have children, she should make sure that she could operate on the assumption that it's non-Jewish sperm. Now, if Sonner was upset by his rejection of the Mamzer idea. They were even more upset by the notion that here you have a rabbi, supposedly a great rabbi, indeed he was a great rabbi, a great posek, suggesting that infertile Jewish women get impregnated by non-Jews, albeit through sperm donors, and they thought that was a tremendous desecration of Kedusha. And again, Rav Avadja also says in a very polite, restrained way that this is not the path that he would suggest. In any particular way. And I'll tell you the truth, Rav Moshe's last tshuva is highly enigmatic, and it's hard for us to even make sense of it. In other words, after he was relentlessly attacked by Satmar and by other people over and over and over again, in his very last tshuva he says that although nothing I said in my earlier tshuvas is incorrect, it's all correct, but I withdraw my heter. Now, it's hard to know what that means. I mean, it's not like, you know, a heter is not like a magical thing that a priest gives you. It's not like a dispensation. I mean, a rabbi, you know, even though the language you use is sometimes not even the right language, a rabbi doesn't give a heter. I mean, we talk that way, but that's not really a correct way of saying it. It's not like a rabbi gives you a heter.
A rabbi is somebody who looks into the halacha and determines that halacha permits something or not. So when a rabbi says it's mutter, he's not giving you a heter, he's telling you halacha maters it. So it's hard to know what the sentence even means, where Moshe says, everything that I said is right, but I'm not giving you a heter. I mean, that only works if you're giving a heter. It doesn't work if you're showing that something is mutter. But be it as it may, I think it's fairly clear that and the Poskim in Eretz Yisrael in particular thought it was a very repulsive and repugnant suggestion that a woman should ever be impregnated by non-Jewish sperm. So we would have to say that this is not an acceptable idea. And with Jewish sperm, the issue is, as they say, the possibility of incest and the like. And now again, most Poskim do agree with Reb Moshe that even if the woman is married, there is no mamzer issue and there is no adultery issue. But they do consider the problem of secret incest to be a significant problem. Now, let me just mention one other aspect of this. Obviously we'll have to have a second session. But one other aspect which has come up recent years, and again, it's very interesting, and really it shows you, it's a bit of a sociological limelight on some of the crises of modern society. That is, what about a single unmarried woman? Now, this is not a frivolous question because and this has been asked by sincere women. Now, there are women who haven't found their shidduch, haven't found their bashert. We do have what is called a shidduch crisis in Klal Yisrael. That is a serious problem that we need to work on and the like. But when push comes to shove, woman hasn't found her bashert, 35, 36, close to 40, fertility options are going to be declining, and one could understand the desire that at least I could have a child that a woman could love and a woman could raise. Now, what some people are doing, and this is totally improper, but to be honest, is that they actually are having affairs with married men, or they become a pilegesh, or whatever it is. I don't want to get into that whole issue, which is a very, very sad issue. But the question has been raised, what about impregnation with a sperm donor? So there's no affair here, there's no adultery here, there's no affecting somebody's marriage. Is there a problem with a single woman getting impregnated with a sperm? Certainly, the Satmar Rebbe's problems wouldn't exist. There's no adultery, there's no mamzer there. So this shaila has not been asked that many times. We don't have a lot of written tshuva about it. This is generally dealt with confidentiality. What the Poskim have come up with is the following idea, the very few that have written about it. They have not been able to say that it's categorically usur. What exactly is the isur of a single woman getting impregnated with sperm if there's no tashmish? But they have said that such an idea generally is against the moral structure of the Torah. Meaning there is a concept sometimes that something can be against the basic orientation of Judaism, even if you can't identify a precise isser that's being violated. What's so bad about it? I mean, you can't just say, oh, it's against Judaism. You have to try to identify what philosophical, spiritual norm is being violated. So one is the idea that Chazal teach us that the way children come into the world is through a threefold partnership. A father and a mother and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we recognize the idea that in order for a child's neshama to get the nurturing that it needs, optimally, you need a father and a mother. Now, of course, in the real world, there are, of course, many children who are not raised with a father and a mother. There is death. There is divorce. Those are things that happen. Those are things that just happen. But they are not deliberately creating a child who is not going to have a father. In other words, it's a very different situation. Death and divorce are things that happen after marriage. But to deliberately have a child without a father is keneged the Ratzon HaTorah, that every child should have an av and an aim in order to bring the Shechina as the third partner. That is one idea. Now again, this is a it's important to emphasize this is not an iser per se. See, sometimes a psak halacha is not based on something being osir, but it's based on the idea of hashkaf. In fact, this, by the way, is a major disagreement between what you might call modern orthodoxy, certainly absolutely open orthodoxy, which is to the left of modern orthodoxy, and more traditional orthodoxy. And that is, modern orthodoxy, or maybe open orthodoxy, I should say, instead of modern, without getting into all of the important chilukim, kind of believes if you can't point to something that is osur, then by definition, what a gadol says is only public policy, it's only etza, and it's not binding in any way. We don't really believe that. We believe that gedolei Torah are there to teach us not only about what is osur and what is mutter. A gadol is not like a plumber or an air conditioning repairman in which they have a specialty in halacha and their opinions on other things don't count. A gadol is also designed to teach us the kind of hashkafa we should have in life. And you understand that this idea of deliberately bringing in a child without... Now, it's one thing... By the way, I would differentiate between a single mother adopting a child and a single mother getting impregnated with sperm. Adoption is a different issue. Because adoption, you already have a child without a father and a mother. And although you could argue that if she doesn't adopt, maybe some other couple will adopt, but maybe not. There are kids who don't have homes. If there's an existing child, and a single mother can give that child a home, albeit there'll be problems of yichud and the giyah, which we talked about, then I think that's fine, because there's already a child that needs the home. But to deliberately create a child who will not have a father is a problem. And there's a problem number two as well. There is a fear that this might be a way of circumventing the need to get married. Because frankly, one of the things that push people to get married is, I want to have kids. So now you say, well, you don't need to get married to have kids. You can do it another way. So for Kerek, maybe the last thing we need in our Jewish society is to create incentives not to get married. So as a result, Gedolim do not encourage this. But I will tell you, to be honest, now Rav Avadya does not have a tshuva about single woman. My guess is he would have been very shocked and abhorred, knowing because he was a relatively conservative person on these types of inyanim. But there is a chashuva posek, and again, a man that I respect, he is a Talmud Chacham, Rav Yuval Shurlo, who is a posek in the Dati Lumi community, who actually did write a tshuva in which he set out conditions that if certain conditions were met, he would permit a religious woman to utilize a sperm bank for impregnation. And his conditions were that she must have been seeking a bashet, seeking a shidduch conscientiously for at least 10 years. She kind of has to put in the ishtadlus to really, really try to get married. Now, how do you measure that exactly? What's putting in the ishtadlus? But he did put in a 10-year waiting period, both in terms of her ishtadlus to get married and in terms of her getting older and her chances of fertility declining. Okay, so these are, again, these are sad issues, in effect. The fact that we have to worry about these things is something that's very, very sad. Let me see what time it is. I think I'm going to hold this over. Yeah. Okay, so I'll just tell you what we'll talk about next week, because this will be a part two here. We're going to move into in vitro fertilization, surrogacy, and egg donation. Now, egg donation and surrogacy are just female variations of the AID, right? AID is using sperm from a third party. Egg donation and surrogacy are using the female components from a third party, either the egg or the womb. But you can see right off the bat, I hope you see, that when you're using borrowed female components, the question becomes a bit more complicated, because then you have the issue of Jewish identity. Because Judaism, right? Sperm will not affect whether the child is Jewish. Whether it's Jewish sperm, non-Jewish sperm, the child will be Jewish. But when you're using donated eggs, or when you're using a third person's womb, another woman's womb, then you really have a very serious halachic. Yeah, there are many halachic shailas here, but one of the halachic shailas is if a Jewish woman uses the donated egg of a non-Jewish woman, and the Jewish woman carries the baby, is the child Jewish, or does the child need conversion? Vice versa, if a Jewish woman's egg carried in the body of a non-Jewish surrogate, is the child Jewish? Just the opposite question. Right? Judaism follows the mother, but is the mother the genetic egg donor, or is the mother the one that carried the baby? Right? We'll have to discuss that issue. But besides that, there'll also be issues of adultery and the issues of yichus and incest, and we'll try to discuss that next week. So, y'all have a good week. Yeah, sure.
The issue of
yes, it's been suggested. In fact, the Rabbanut has issued guidelines for egg donation, not sperm donation, but it would be the same principle, that the hospitals do have to keep records of who the donors are, so that whenever there's a marriage, the Rabbanut would have access to determine that the two people are not related to each other and are permitted to marry.
And on this issue of single motherhood,
yeah.
Last issue spoke about. Is there a preference in halacha for a Jewish donor?
Yeah, so here you do run into a bit of a double bind, because Sherlo is not considering two problems. That is, with respect to the non-Jewish sperm, which would be preferable in terms of ensuring that brother and sister not marry in the future, you do have the spiritual desecration that many Gedolim have described of non-Jewish Zera entering a Jewish woman. In terms of Jewish sperm, unless you keep a donor registry, you have the problem of brother and sister. So I would have to say that the preference here would be Jewish sperm with a confidential registry that only the Rabbanut would have access to determine that there wouldn't be a brother-sister matchup later on. And of course, in the state of Israel, your assumption would be the opposite of the United States, that most sperm donors would be Jewish. Now, one other thing, I do want to point out that it is probably halachically prohibited to be a sperm donor, meaning to say, if you go back to the beginning of my talk, when I talked about a husband being allowed to give his sperm for insemination of his wife, because since he's doing it for the purpose of his having a child, so that's considered to be legitimate, that would not be a heter for a sperm donor who is simply giving sperm for money and has no intention of raising the child. So halachically, a person is not allowed to be a sperm donor, but that doesn't really change the fact that if there is a sperm donation, a woman might be allowed to use it, provided the secret incest problem doesn't occur. Yeah.
Yes, when you spoke about the Sadeh Rebbe initially about the problem with Mamzerim,
yep.
When Moshe Feinstein said the sperm of a non-Jew, that would take away from Mamzerim.
That's correct.
Because if a woman has relations with a non-Jew,
yep.
And there's a child, the child is not...
Absolutely, absolutely correct. That takes away Mamzer. Even the Sadeh Rebbe would have to concede that it would not be a Mamzer. His objection to non-Jew was the Tumah of a non-Jew. It was not a Mamzer problem.
Point of information,
yep. By the way, I just want to point out, this is an extremely important halacha that sometimes... rabbis don't even notice. I don't know why, but again, Rav Grafstein is 100% correct that if a Jewish married woman commits adultery with a non-Jewish man, the child is not a mamzer. It's very important to know that. Yeah.
Point of information on the Ben Mida and Ras Mida.
Yeah.
First of all, Moshe Feinstein, Shimon Iyer quotes in his Ras Mida in the beginning. Moshe Feinstein, maybe the woman was swimming at the time.
That's right. That's
maybe
right.
It was a case that occurred in Lakewood many, many years ago, where there was a fellow getting engaged, and then the father of the bride said, "But his family's not observant. I don't want my daughter to marry a Ben Mida." Rav Aaron Kotler said, "The power of Torah is a purification, the Eisha Torah that comes into a person,
yep.
that little pegamen in the Shema
yep.
is gone."
Yeah, that's important. In other words, this is a real question that people raise, and that is... How could I marry a balas tshuva? She was conceived nida, or vice versa. How could the woman marry a boy who's a bal tshuva as a ben nida? Good, there's no mamzer problem, but is there a spiritual pagam? So there are two mahalchim. Again, as Rav Grafstein said, Rav Moshe developed the mahalich, which is a little far-fetched, but he said it's a possibility, that the oraisa, a woman could remove the status of nida in all sorts of ways. Swimming pools might be kosher mikvahs and this and that. So even though we would never lechatchila allow that, but who says we can't make an assumption that it was fixed? By the way, Rav Moshe knows of what he spoke, because when he was a Rav in Stalinist Russia, he actually converted a swimming pool into a mikveh under the very eyes of the communists. He just said, as he suggested, certain improvements that would make it a better swimming pool. And he had in mind, he made it a kosher mikveh. It's quite amazing. He didn't use it. That's right. That's right. That's right. So that's Rav Moshe's answer. But the Stipler gave, I think, an answer that, is easier to accept. And he said that the rule that a ben nida has a spiritual pagam is a presumption. We assume that that's the case. But if you see a person with good midas, and you see a person with erlich, that means they're a yotzei min haklal. Meaning, you look at a person's character, ultimately, and you don't go with artificial tests. And there are people who manage to surmount it. Now, Rav Aaron added that point, that the koach of the Torah can purify you, but for a woman as well, even if she's not learning in yeshiva, her maisim tovim, her chesed. So the bottom line is that even very strict gedolim, I mean, the Stipler was a very machmer gadol. He basically said one should not refrain from marrying a ben or a bas nida if their midos are good and pure, and if the man is very devoted to studying of Torah, because ultimately it is your character that counts much more than the status of what happened with your parents. Yes, well, this is a difficult one. I remember, I'll tell you this. I don't want to be quiet. No, there actually was, I don't know if there still is, there probably still is, there was an organization in New York, going by the name Shalom Bias, of all bizarre names, that kind of coordinated pilagshin for married men who wanted to have affairs and provide some solace for women who couldn't find their basherets. And these women, of course, go to the mikveh. They're from women. I mean, these women were interviewed anonymously. And, of course, this appeared in the Washington Post, of all places. So that's all we need for Chilul Hashem. But the thing that hits me most was the just tremendous, tremendous sadness. This was not joy that the women were describing. These are religious women. These are sincere women. Some of them are teachers in Beis Yaakov's. They're not promiscuous women. These are women who desperately want to get married, and they want to keep halacha, and they keep taras and mishpacha, and they just felt there was no brera in their lives. The desperation was so moving and really so powerful. Just from the interviews, it's just from the words in the newspaper article. Now, the halachic heter of this is based on some Rishonim, and again, we'll be honest, that actually say that that a man is allowed to have what is called a pilegish. That means a dedicated mistress who is not a prostitute, who doesn't go around with other people, and it is possible to have a dedicated pilegish without running afoul of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom against polygamy, and they follow this view. Now, all I can tell you is that although I can't deny that there is such a view in halacha, but the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, or the Shulchan Aruch based on the Rambam, reject this, and they say that there's an Isser D'Oraisa to have relations outside of marriage. And the people who do this are following a Das Yochid in the Rishonim that the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam do reject. Now, do they have nobody that supports what they're doing? I can't say that. There are Shitas that do support it. But I think that the Minog of Am Yisrael has been to reject that idea of polygamy. By the way, I just want to tell you, in 19th century Morocco, there was actually a proposal by a very esteemed dayan in Morocco that there was a problem of agunas, right? Women who were married, who didn't get their get, were stuck. So there actually was a proposal, hey, why don't we solve the aguna problem by getting rid of marriage? And all relationships of men and women should be done via pilegesh, and we'll draw up economic agreements of support, and that ishtar, and in that way, when it's time to leave, the woman can just leave or the man can just leave. You don't need a get. Now, to me, that's kind of like saying, if I have a mosquito problem, let's use an atom bomb to kill the mosquito. I mean, to say, let's get rid of marriage to solve the aguna problem. Aguna is a very serious problem, to be sure, but you don't kind of kill the idea of marriage to solve aguna. But there actually was a proposal that the aguna problem was considered to be so serious that let's go back and have the pilegish. But
what a nice last story.